case number 20-3922, Elizabeth Walson, First USA. Oral argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Clear, please call the roll.
You may proceed.
Your honors, and may it please the court, my name is Daron Kalir, and I'm here to represent the appellant, Mr. Liston Watson. If the court may, I would like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you, your honors. This case is about a breached plea agreement. My client was promised to serve not more than 360 months in return for admission in certain violations. The agreement called for no more than 360 months, but the sentencing, your honors, exceeded that level, and my client was sentenced in addition to that sentence to 2 consecutive days drawn concurrently in addition to the promised deal.
Consecutive days to run concurrently with each other, is that right? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, the 2 days to run, yes, your honor. So it was 1 day over the 360 months.
They really weren't. It's 2 days over, but they really weren't consecutive.
Yes, Your Honor. And so because the court violated the terms of the plea agreement, in according to the plea agreement itself, in according to Rule 11C5, and in as the government admitted, at that point, my client should have been offered the option to withdraw from the plea agreement. He was never offered to do so. His client admittedly at the time did not object, and so my client was sentenced above and beyond the promised plea agreement. He wanted to present that issue before this honorable court on direct appeal, but the performance of his own counsel was so dismal that this court considered that argument abandoned. And so he filed a 2255 motion below, and he argued that claim again to be denied, and the court below also denied the COA, or Certificate of Appealability. But this honorable court, Judge Rogers, allowed 2 issues for appeal. The first issue, Your Honor, is whether my client could show cause and prejudice to overcome his double procedural default. The first procedural default was by not objecting at the moment that the plea agreement was breached, and the second, because of the dismal performance on appeal by appellate counsel. 2 separate counsels, Your Honor.
Can I interject with a question here? You keep using the term breached, but aren't you really claiming that the district court just didn't enforce the plea agreement or violated its terms? Because the government didn't breach this agreement. The government was a party to it. But the court's not a party to the plea agreement, right?
Correct, Your Honor. The court is not a party to the plea agreement, no.
So you're not really talking about a breach. You're talking about the court not enforcing the agreement according to its terms and not permitting, since it didn't, not permitting a withdrawal of the plea. But that's not a breach, right?
Correct, Your Honor, and I apologize. Rule 11C5 talks about rejecting a plea agreement. So when the court rejects a plea agreement, he must advise the defendant personally that the court is not required to follow the plea agreement and give the defendant an opportunity to withdraw the plea. From the perspective of my client, the plea agreement was breached, or that the court rejected the plea agreement as promised or as is, and therefore the court at that point should have given the defendant the opportunity to withdraw the plea, but the court did not do so.
And I understand you were not around when this occurred, but it seems like this was an easily fixable problem. The court didn't really give any indication, as I understand it, that it intended to reject the plea agreement. There was some little colloquy which the court seems to have understood as requiring these 2 more days, and then nobody managed to point out that that was not, in fact, in compliance with the plea agreement. So I do not understand. Well, one, I'm going to have an opportunity to ask the government about its position, but it would seem that it would have been a pretty easy thing for the lawyers to get together, go back in, advise the judge what had happened, and get the sentence corrected, because there's not really any indication that the court intended to reject the plea agreement. It's something that just sort of happened by some random thing about these 2 days that was tossed out there. Do you disagree with that characterization? Do you disagree with that characterization?
Your Honor, I wouldn't say that I disagree with that characterization, but I would like to open the lens a little bit and explain what exactly happened during the colloquy. So first, we're looking now at document number 71, page ID 304. This is the sentencing hearing. So at the end of the sentencing hearing, these are the last two pages, the court says, okay, counselors, is there any reason known to either of you that would prevent the court from imposing a sentence as stated for the reasons that I have stated? Mr. Gallagher, which is the attorney for my client at the time, during sentence, he says, not that I'm aware of. And here where it starts, the court, Mr. Oakley, AUSA, Mr. Oakley, just so I'm clear, it's on the two banks, 1 and 5, Your Honor, that means count 1 and 5, is 1 day for the time served? That's a question. The court answers, I think it didn't break it down that way, but, and then the AUSA intervenes, I think the recommendation, and I think by that, Your Honor, he means the PSR recommendation, was 1 day with time served. That would give us the 360 months. The court, all right, 1 day on count 1 and 5 with credit for time served, followed by 360 months of imprisonment, and Mr. Watson will receive credit for the time served awaiting sentence. Correct? Mr. Oakley, yes, Your Honor. The court, okay then. I will impose the sentence as I've stated it for the reasons that I've stated. And Mr. Watson, I'm obliged to advise you that you have the right to appeal this sentence. So at this point, I agree with Your Honor that it seems that the court itself was under the impression that it follows, or it is following, the agreed upon plea agreement, but it wasn't. And my client was not advised, and according to the law and in according to the terms of the plea agreement itself, at that point that he can withdraw. And
I don't understand why the lawyers involved weren't focused on fixing this before it got to this point.
I believe, Your Honor, that my client's counsel at that point did not provide effective assistance. I think he should have.
Well, that may be, but it seems like the government wasn't exercising common sense either. So, I mean, 6 of 1 and a half dozen of the other, perhaps.
Yes, Your Honor, but it's important to understand that my client at that point already filed two separate motions to withdraw the plea. He really wanted out of the plea. I think that the government's attempt to argue the opposite is inaccurate at best. And I think that when the court deviates, and thank you, Judge Batchelder, for correcting me on that, when the court deviates from the agreed upon plea agreement, then it must provide the client the opportunity to withdraw.
Is the object at this point to get the plea agreement enforced as originally written, or is the object to withdraw it and try to see if you can do better in another world?
The latter, Your Honor, and if I may, I want to perhaps preempt an argument by the government which they start with, suggesting that my client did not want to withdraw. Again, looking at the record, at document number 110, pages 522, when my client is being asked by his own lawyer at the time, this is the 2255 hearing below, and what is it that you're asking this court to do? Answer, this is my client, vacate the sentence for remand for resentencing. And I think, Your Honor, by that, my client suggests that he wants to withdraw the plea. Now, the court intervenes and asks my client, you are not asking that the court specifically enforce the agreement you already made? And that, Your Honor, Judge Gibbons, goes straight to your question. So the court asks basically the same. You are not asking that the court specifically enforce the agreement you already made? The witness answers, I didn't quite understand. The court then tries again. One of the possible remedies for a breach of a plea agreement is for the court to order that the plea agreement be enforced. And so my understanding is that you are not asking that because that would only result in your sentence being reduced by 1 day, right? So there's a negative element to that question here. And my client answered, no, Your Honor. And I'm not clear for once what does no mean under those circumstances. The court continues to probe. Oh, you're not asking for that? The witness, yes, I am asking for that. And if Your Honors are confused at this point, welcome to the club. This is a very confusing colloquy, and I think that the government picking, literally cherry-picking one question and one word to answer out of this colloquy to suggest that my client did not want to withdraw his plea is really misleading at best. So the court continues, so you want your sentence reduced by one day and you'd be satisfied if that happens? The witness, I didn't believe that that would be a possibility if I was remanded for sentencing. The court, oh no, that would be different from resentencing. That would be an enforcement of the actual agreement you already made by reducing your sentence by one day. That's not what you're asking for? The witness, no. And so it goes on for pages and pages and pages. And at one point, the government is correct that his attorney is asking him, so you're not asking the court to withdraw your plea, correct? And my client answers, no. But taking that or cherry-picking that one-word answer from a colloquy or four pages where it is clear to me, with all due respect, that my clients want to withdraw his plea is, in my mind, simply insincere. And with that, Your Honor, I see that my time has come to an end.
Okay. We'll hear from you, Mr. Zuhari. Ms. Zuhari, excuse me.
Good morning. May it please the court, Alexis Zuhari on behalf of the United States. I'd like to refocus a little bit this morning. This case is about one additional day of imprisonment, but the claims that are before this court are ineffective assistance of counsel claims.
We understand that. The basis for my questions is when I see a simple way to fix what is apparently being asked for, and the attorneys are before us, you know, after much other procedure, I have to wonder whether the attorneys think that the court, that this is a good use of our time when it could probably have been resolved at an earlier point in time. Is it a good use of the resources of the United States? Is it a good use of the resources of defense counsel? I'm just not sure.
I understand your concerns, Your Honor, and to be candid, I agree with them. There's been a lot of time and ink spilled over this one day. And to Judge Batchelder's point, you know, you're correct, Judge Batchelder. I think the proper framing for this is that there was a Rule 11 error. Everyone in the courtroom was trying to honor this bargain. Everyone in the courtroom was trying and thought they were, in fact, giving the defendant the 360-month sentence that to which he was entitled. Now he didn't actually get that. If an objection had been made at that point, then there would have been an opportunity to fix the error. Of course, no one actually realized there was an error because they were imposing this additional day with credit for time served.
But aren't we really talking about something more than just an additional day here? And maybe I'm just wrong about this, but I thought part of the deal was he wasn't doing any time on those dismissed charges, and he ends up doing, it's only a day, but what's the impact of that when the deal was that he was only going to be sentenced on the ones that he was getting the 360 months for, but in fact he got a day for something other than that. What's the impact of that?
Your Honor, I think that under the fourth prong of plain error, that it's certainly an additional day of his liberty, but it's not an additional day that seriously affects the fairness of the court or the integrity or reputation.
A day of imprisonment that you're not supposed to be having does not affect the fairness of the system. I mean, it is a day. It's a day of imprisonment, and this is a 360 month sentence. But I mean, say he was sentenced to 3 days or 5 days, and he gets an extra day. Extra day would certainly mean a lot there, wouldn't it? And I mean, nobody wants an extra day, do they?
Certainly, Your Honor.
I mean, how does that not affect the fairness of the system if he has a sentence that violates the agreement?
Your Honor, I think that in this context, this is sort of why the fourth prong of plain error exists. It's for a situation like the one here, where if an objection had been made on the spot, this could have been figured out.
But it's ineffective assistance of trial counsel there for failing to object at sentencing. And you have ineffective assistance of appellate counsel for the reason stated in my opinion in the previous case here, that the brief was so perfunctory that he really had abandoned the issue. He recognized there was an issue, but the briefing was so bad, there was no oral argument, that they really we just had to conclude that the issue was abandoned. So, I mean, you have ineffective assistance of trial counsel and appellate counsel, and that's what 2255 is all about, isn't it? I mean, this... I'm not quite sure why you haven't confessed error. I mean, it's one day, but it's obvious error. It does affect substantial rights. And rather than spend our time, it would have been much better if you'd confessed error and we'd gotten this thing resolved earlier. Instead, it's going on and on over one day.
Agreed, Your Honor. On that last point, everyone is looking for finality at this point. A few responses, if I may. First, as to the plain error standard, even if this additional day affects substantial rights, the question under the fourth prong of plain error is a different one. And I think that just that one day doesn't get you over the hump. And there are a few reasons for that. First, because in this specific context, and Puckett, the Supreme Court decision that we cite in our brief, does compel this court to really look at the specific facts here. And there are three features that I think show why this doesn't satisfy the fourth prong of plain error. First, that's that the government and the district court attempted to, and in fact thought they were, giving the defendant the bargain to which he was entitled. Now, at the same time, they were doing this because they were trying to comply with the statutory requirements that had been pointed out in the probation report. But
could I interrupt? Could I interrupt just at this point? Correct me if I'm wrong on the facts, but my recollection of this is that it was really important to this defendant that he do no time on, I think it was the bank robbery charges, but that he be sentenced only on the firearms charges. That was important. And so he ended up not getting that deal because he got sentenced on the firearms charges, but he also got sentenced to time on the bank robbery charges, which apparently was very important to him. He not be the case. Is there any impact at all, to his having received a sentence for those charges that he thought he had a deal that he wasn't going to get sentenced on? Does that have any long-term impact? I mean, if he gets out and starts committing other crimes, does it make any difference?
I don't think, given the charges that he was convicted of, the 2924Cs and the two bank robbery counts, that there were collateral consequences, if that's what the court is referring to. I think that really, when you step back and look at the fourth prong of plain error, in a situation like this, where you have a defendant who was looking at a mandatory minimum of 107 years, and the defendant received a C1C plea to 30 years, six counts were dismissed, including three 924C counts. He got a significant downward variance on the bank robbery counts. And I think when you look at this one day in the context of everything that happened in the proceedings below, which is what Puckett says we have to do, it shows, and the district court below and the magistrate judge below found, that Mr. Watson could not have satisfied the fourth prong of plain error.
I find it a little bit... I would expect the United States to not be litigating this at this point based on an argument that it's not plain error because what does another day matter? I mean, the United States apparently concedes that the plea agreement was not honored at this point, even though the United States may have occasioned the error in the first place. But that just doesn't seem to me to be the litigation posture that the United States ought to have had throughout this matter. And it shouldn't be in the interest of the United States to erroneously suggest that the court should impose an extra day, end up with a sentence that, at a minimum, is not in technical compliance with the plea agreement, and then spend years, probably, I haven't looked at the time frame, trying to litigate this based on plain error rather than trying to fix it, which was likely within the power of the United States to do very, very easily. And I understand you weren't there, but, you know, the United States is supposed, if you're a U.S. attorney, what you want to do is you want people to think your office has integrity and that you honor your commitments. That would be my thought. And this just doesn't come across as very pretty, even though it is just one day.
I understand Your Honor's concerns and frustrations. As Your Honor noted, I came onto the scene late here.
Well, I know, and I'm sorry to be fussing at you, and I don't even know that we're the people who created the original mess may not even be employed by the U.S. Attorney's Office anymore. But so I understand that I have perhaps unfairly challenged you about it, but you're the one who's here.
Your Honor, I understand. You know, as both you and Judge Batchelder and Judge Griffin have pointed out, certainly wish that we weren't here today, that this had been resolved at the point at which it could have been. I would note, I believe that the trial attorney below did offer Mr. Watson a new plea deal to try to make this go away. That clearly didn't happen, in large part because I do think that Mr. Watson here, the end game, if you look at the evidentiary hearing, is that he's trying to get a more favorable sentence under the revised penalties of the First Step Act. He's obviously not entitled to that benefit at this point. But I do think that if you look back at the evidentiary hearing, he's not seeking the two remedies to which he would be entitled under Rule 11, which is give the district court the opportunity to impose the 360 if it can do so legally, or give him the opportunity to withdraw. And he did disclaim.
He might have another agenda at this point, but has the United States ever offered, ever agreed to either of the remedies that would get him the sentence he originally bargained for?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that, Your Honor?
Well, you said, well, now he wants something else, but then you mentioned that the two remedies that I had suggested earlier, and has the United States ever offered those?
I believe the United States offered him a plea agreement below the 360. I don't think that's in the record.
What was that?
What is in the record is that the United States did come forward and did make him a plea offer, and that was rejected. That is in the record of the evidentiary hearing, the post-conviction evidentiary hearing.
Counsel, if we agree with petitioner's argument on appeal, what remedy should we impose at this point?
I think the remedy, Your Honor, would be that the district court has the opportunity below, like in a Rule 11 violation case, to either impose the agreed-upon sentence, which was 360 months, or to reject the agreement, at which point Mr. Watson would be entitled to withdraw. But I think the district court, under Rule 11, should be given the opportunity to first accept the agreement that it thought it had accepted a long time ago.
Okay, they're asking for a new direct appeal. You don't think that's the remedy?
I'm not sure in this context, Your Honor, that that really makes much sense. That might make sense in a 2254 context. But this court is the court that would actually decide the fourth prong plain error issue if we're talking about ineffective assistance of appellate counsel. And so it seems to be there would be even more of a waste of resources for this panel to initiate a new direct appeal. I think this panel is fit to decide the matter as it sees fit. If there are no further questions, we ask that the court affirm. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Collier, your rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honors, and may it please the court. I would like to address very briefly some of the points that were raised with Ms. Zuhari. The first, I would refer this court to document number 108 in the record, page ID 473, for what seems to be a new plea agreement between the government and my client, Liston Watson. It is not signed. Let me be very clear on the record here. It is not signed by the United States. It is signed by my client. He claims that by the time he wanted to agree to that, the government did not agree. I do not state before this court that any of that is true, but I do want the court's attention to the document to note that it is in the record.
And
second thing, Your Honors, with regard to Paquette, as I mentioned in my reply brief, the government see Paquette as the panacea to all its ills. But with all due respect, I think the exact opposite is true. Paquette dealt with a person who confessed to assistance to fraud between the plea agreement and sentencing. Surely the government could not stand in sentencing and say, yes, let's reduce it by three levels, because he already, between those two dates, confessed to assistance to fraud. This is what Justice Scalia meant when he talks about contravailing factors. And not like in the case at hand, that nothing happened between those dates. And I don't think that, or in other words, I do think that Paquette buttresses, rather than weakens, this court's Swanberg from 2004, Hamphill from 2007, and Shropshire from 2008, all mentioned in page 33 of our opening brief, that goes exactly to the fourth prong to suggest that indeed, even a one-day violation or any exceeding of the deprivation of liberty should satisfy the fourth prong. Finally, I would like to turn this court attention to Filson, another Seventh Circuit case from last year that the U.S. seems to be relying upon. In Filson, they allowed a $200 violation from the plea agreement, and indeed, Your Honor, 18 U.S. Code 2113, the bank robbery charges that we're talking about, both A and D allow for either imprisonment or fined or both, meaning the or both suggests that fines are fine, pardon the pun, and then therefore the court could have fined my client $100 a day for each of those violations, and then we wouldn't be here. But this is not what happened. Filson, before concluding, adds the following, which is missing from the government's brief. We often reserve an error of an increased defendant's term of imprisonment because the risk of unnecessary deprivation of liberty particularly undermines the fairness, integrity, or public reputation of the judicial proceeding. In other words, and then they write, but this is not what happened here. In other words, even the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, Your Honor, understand the great difference between $200 deviation from the agreement and a deprivation of liberty. And even for the Seventh Circuit, they think that such a deprivation do satisfy the fourth prong. So for all those reasons, Your Honor, we ask that you reverse the decision of the district court and allow my clients to withdraw from his guilty plea.
Okay. Any further questions?
No.
Well, I mean, technically, the 2255 petition is ineffective assistance of counsel, and isn't the issue we decide is whether it's reasonably probable that absent the ineffective assistance of counsel that the outcome would have been different? I mean, isn't that the only issue before us?
Your Honor, there are two issues before of you, and I apologize. By the time my time is up, may I finish my answer?
Well, the other one is the procedural default. But that's kind of, that's tied to the ineffective assistance, right?
Correct, Your Honor. But if there is a double procedural default, then
I think Judge Griffith is trying to still talk to you. You know, we've got a problem, a technical problem, where when we're trying to ask you a question, if you're not keeping your eyes on us and if you're looking down, you may not hear it. I was trying to interrupt you unsuccessfully earlier, and now Judge Griffin is, so keep your eyes on us so you'll know.
I mean, you're just saying that we should remand and allow him to withdraw his plea, but technically the issue is for us is whether it's reasonably probable that absent the ineffective assistance of counsel, the result would be changed, and we remand it, but we don't normally rule on the merits, do we? Honor?
Yes, Your Honor. First, I would like to apologize both to Judge Gibbons and to you, Your Honor. I'm sorry, I was not aware of that. And yes, Your Honor, under Strickland, these are the questions presented exactly.
All right. Well, if there's nothing further, we appreciate the arguments both of you have given, and we'll consider the case carefully. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.